Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Beating Back the Heat, Solving Thermal Management Challenges in Military Electronics. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Greg Shippen, Fellow and Chief Architect, Embedded Solutions at AMD, Margaret Schmidt, Electronics Business Development Director at ANSYS, and Mark Palillo, Director of Engineering for Wakefield Vet. Before we get started, I have some housekeeping announcements. The eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. I also want to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. Use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. Next important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The other button on your console window that is important allows you to enter questions in real time. And we'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to all of our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over to our first speaker, Margaret Schmidt. Margaret, take it away.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today. Start things off, let's highlight a few of the trends we are seeing in aerospace as well as military electronic systems as a whole. Now, certainly we're seeing more smart devices and connected devices taking prominent roles, not just in the area of UAVs and autonomous vehicles, but also in wearable and mobile devices. Which are critical for enabling battlefield communication, providing GPS coordinates locations, monitoring a soldier's vital signs in the field. And engineering these products requires us to integrate a large number of electrical components within a very confined, limited space. And as we're bringing these high-performance processors, antennas, and other complex components into these systems, we're creating challenges for power and thermal management we haven't really seen in previous generations of electronic design. And while performance and cost remain chief concerns for these military systems, power efficiency is the key enabler for these systems. Power impacts the size and weight of the required energy storage or energy generation solution, like a battery packs, for example. Power impacts the endurance and reliability of the entire system under its target operating conditions. Say, for example, a more power-efficient design will enable you to have a longer mission time. And finally, power consumption directly impacts the total heat dissipated by the system. And it's therefore a critical concern as engineers make design trade-offs to optimize the cooling solutions on a target system. For example, design decisions they may have to make. Should it be air-cooled versus liquid cooling? And this is going to be a critical decision that will impact the size, weight, and cost. And ultimately, the performance of that system. And so kind of to start things off, to implement an effective cooling solution, what I'd like to highlight is how we can look at power efficiency and thermal management strategies together from early stage of the design process to achieve design success. So let's look at the components of these military electronic systems and their impact then on the thermal signature of the system. Now when I'm talking about some of these components, certainly when we're talking about your power electronic modules, ASICs, FPGAs, electrical components very often that are ruggedized and designed specifically for these military applications and also maybe designed to be more power efficient. Which is great for these applications. You're looking at longer battery lifetime, And also, more power efficient means less heat being dissipated in the system. And as we take a look at what the impact of that, the heat dissipation of that component is, you know, we're also looking at how heat in that system can impact the actual component's reliability. Certainly, as the temperature increases, we may see reliability issues. We may see circuit slowdown due to high heat. So definitely, we want to take a look at implementing a power efficient and thermal efficient system. Looking at the thermal management design decisions we would need to make. What will our cooling solution be? What would be the impact, for example, on the design decisions I need to make on a package around that chip? What material properties should I use for that package design? Keeping in mind swap restrictions, keeping in mind cost restrictions, which, of course, for military electronics is always key, the trend to ever and ever increased focus on cost reduction. So while we're trying to implement an efficient cooling solution, we need to keep cost and design time in mind. And certainly another example I'd like to highlight here is the impact of your heat dissipation and the thermal effects on your structural integrity. Now, when we're looking here at military electronic systems, you're looking at systems with really zero tolerance for failure, whether that's an aircraft, whether it's a UAV, or some sort of mission-critical component. We need to ensure that the heat dissipation doesn't have a fatal or negative impact on our electronics reliability. Perfect example, of course, would be thermal cycling and the impact, for example, on solder ball reliability. Just to name a concrete example there. Now, I mentioned electronic components, and I named a few examples. Just wanted to highlight, okay, where are these fitting in? What is the role of some of these complex electronics in military systems? And certainly, you can see a wide variety here. This is for sure just a few examples. High-performance processor chips, this is needed as we're bringing more decision-making, more sensor data into these systems. Image sensors, of course, for relaying high-resolution images, for example, and, of course, the need for more and more storage as we're bringing in more data collection, we're bringing in more information that we need to store and process, certainly as we move toward autonomous systems, all very critical components together with the other elements of the system and the power supplies and what have you. So here we're looking at a very complex system and a fundamental limitation. Limitation used to be, and some of my colleagues are fond of saying, how much the system is limited by how much power you can provide. Well, now we're essentially being limited by how much power you can cool, because these systems are becoming more complex, and we're bringing in more features and functionality with autonomous operation, with connectivity, and now our challenge is cooling it. Okay. So let's break down that system then, and let's take first of all a look at the factors contributing to these power thermal challenges at the chip level. So we'll start there. Looking at the chip, its operation, essentially what we have here on the lower left corner, we're looking at the power consumption of the chip. And this power consumption is related to a certain mode of operation. And we need to ensure that the power supply, of course, is going to meet the requirements of that component throughout all of its modes of operation in that target system, in its target environment, if that's in the desert, if that's in the cold, if that's at a high altitude. We certainly need to factor that in. Now, at the chip level, we can certainly use low-power design strategies to deactivate unnecessary functional blocks, which are essentially wasting power. And by eliminating that wasted power, we're avoiding some unwanted heat generation. So certainly, very critical step to understand the power consumption of the chip as well as its heat signature. And taking it a step up, let's move from the chip level to the complete chip package board environment. We see that the complexity of these processors and these ICs can certainly increase with, for example, a 3D IC stacked die configuration, where now we need to understand not only the power consumption and the heat generation from a single die, but we're seeing multiple dies, which certainly can build up a critical thermal situation, as well as the packaging board. So we need to understand here what is the heat flow from the actual chip itself. Then certainly we're looking at the heat dissipation from the system. And essentially we need to understand what is that convergent thermal state of the system that is being generated from the heat dissipation from the chip, as well as taking into account the material properties of the package and board, and of course the characteristics of the package and board, how many layers, where are the components placed, and then on top of that overlay then what is our target cooling solution. So if we understand heat dissipation of the chip, its power consumption, we understand the component placement and the package on the board and our material properties, we can then design a efficient thermal cooling solution that hopefully fits within our cost targets and our reliability targets for that system. Now, certainly, just want to point out one you know, fundamental limitation that military electronic designs typically have, and that is most of these designs do not design, these products don't design their own chip, right? The chip is coming from a vendor. And so certainly the task here is to design a cooling solution around that chip's heat dissipation, around that environment, the target package and board. And this can involve decisions for moving for airflow, air cooling versus a liquid cooling, for example, a more expensive package model versus a less expensive package model. So all these design decisions can be made relatively quickly and efficiently if the thermal behaviors of the chip package and board are known. And now I've just wanted to kind of segue and highlight, I've mentioned a few times the impact of thermal effects on system reliability, and I just wanted to share a few of these. Certainly, thermal impact on electrical reliability, looking at this, I mean, we're targeting long-term reliability against zero tolerance for failure for these systems. This is something that certainly can impact us both on the electrical side. For example, we're taking a look at a PCB board, which may be in the cockpit, maybe in the mobile handheld device that a soldier is using to connect and relay images from a drone. You know, certainly as this heats up, we don't want to see reliabilities either on the electrical side or on the mechanical side for structural integrity. And so essentially, just kind of walk through the flow that I've highlighted here, you know, a thermal-aware design flow could start at the chip level, certainly, if a chip design is being done, and can take a look at reducing or eliminating wasted power at the chip level and understanding that chip's power and thermal signature. Bringing in a model of that chip's power and thermal signature into the system and enabling design of the cooling solution and decisions about the PCB, number of layers, component placement, as well as the impact on chip reliability. And essentially, you know, that brings us to a workflow that can enable electrical, thermal, and mechanical engineers to collaborate seamlessly, share information at the chip, package, board, system level, and really detect hotspots, reliability issues that are potentially going to impact the design, and let them mitigate those early in the design flow. And this flow can be used at every level of the system throughout the design phase. Chip designers can optimize the power consumption of their processors. They can eliminate wasted power and minimize their thermal footprint. Likewise, package engineers can take those chip thermal models into their decision-making process and look at optimizing that design. And then certainly the target is to implement a thermally efficient system, including all of the decisions around the cooling solution, air versus liquid, taking into size and weight, as well as cost constraints. And with that, I'd just like to summarize, my own personal feeling and what I've observed is that I believe the power and thermal design challenges for military electronics will only become more and more complex. Certainly, I see this as a challenge at both the chip level and system level to ensure that we are always implementing, power efficient designs and driving the co-simulation of the entire system so we can truly realize an optimized system for both power and thermal efficiency. With that, I'll wrap it up and pass it to the next presenter.
Thank you very much, Margaret. This is John. That's an excellent presentation. Before we get to the next presenter, I just want to remind the audience to keep the questions coming in. And after our third speaker, we will go right to our Q&A. And now for our next speaker, Mark Polillo of Wakefield Vet. Mark, take it away.
Thank you, John. So as we look at the key challenges that are associated with military electronics, some of which Margaret touched on, the military seems to be pushing the envelope even harder than some of the commercial spaces related to how much smaller the components need to be and how much heat needs to be coming out of those components. The amount of power that they're pushing, the overall temperature, all lends to the reliability of the components. And these are all mission critical systems, so there is no chance for failure associated with these. In addition to the thermal properties, we also have to be concerned with the overall weight, the total size of the solution, in certain cases the aesthetics, and the hot swappability. In a lot of cases, these units are used in the field. If for some reason there is a failure, those components need to be quickly and easily swapped out, replaced with a new board or a new component without any downtime in the system. So there's always redundancy based designed into these systems. These systems have to be able to survive extremely high temperature environments. You never know where they're going to be based. If it's a land-based, it could be subject to extreme shock and vibration as the vehicle is moving over the terrain. Same thing if it's air-based, right? You could have high G loads from an aircraft or a UAV trying to execute high velocity maneuvers. So as we look at the typical type of components that's used in a military solution, we typically call these a heat frame, which can be conduction cooled, where your only means of transfer of heat is going to be through the conduction of the material itself. You can also have air cooled and liquid cooled. You may be able to put air through the chassis itself if it's in a controlled environment. If it's in a harsh environment, you're not going to be able to have fans blowing airflow through the system because of dust, dirt, debris, and whatever else may get into the system, eventually clog up the fans, and then cause heat-related failures. So as we look at these conduction frames, we have a couple of pictures of one here. They're designed to sit on the printed circuit board. The pockets have been machined such that we can clear non-critical components, but then we also have pedestals that are going to come down and conduct the heat away from the high-temperature components. As you look at some of the more complex boards, you may be trying to conduct heat from 20 or 30 different devices, but at the same time, you may be trying to clear a number of other components as well. So the tolerancing associated with these and the overall design is extremely complex. In certain cases, the layout of the heat frame may not be for thermal reasons. It may be there solely to handle shock and vibration. a printed circuit board sitting in a chassis that's subject to high vibration may want to bend and twist, which is going to cause reliability issues on the chips themselves. So you can add a heat frame or a stiffener to the board itself just to control how much flex and bow the board actually takes. The advantage of the heat frames is that they don't have any impact on the actual design of the board. They don't impact the VME, compact PCI, or PCI specifications that these individual boards are designed around. They all have allowance in them to have a heat frame of a given thickness so that they can control the pitch between the individual cards. So while you have these conduction frames, you have to be able to keep them in the chassis, and you have to be able to, at the same time, provide a good thermal path to get the heat out of the frame and into the chassis. So one of the components that we produce that's commonly used in the industry is what's known as a wedge lock or a card retainer. These are a series of small wedges that as a screw or a latch is tightened, the wedges press up against each other, they expand, and that provides your clamping force between the board and the physical chassis. The amount of expansion and the amount of contact area between the chassis and the printed circuit board will control how much thermal resistance you have. Again, because these can be hot swappable, that interface has to be a dry interface. You can't use an interface material like a grease or a pad because as soon as you pull the device out and stick the next one in, you'll have destroyed that interface material. So now, assuming you've got all your heat out of your heat frame and you've got it through the wedge lock, now what you have to do is you have to bring it into the chassis itself. Now, the chassis shown on the screen is a very simple example. There's a number of different card slots. There's a spot in the back for a power supply. The unit then has covers on the front and rear, and this is a self-contained unit. The cooling is provided by the fins on the outside of the chassis, so this would be an air-cooled chassis. We have produced liquid-cooled chassis as well. It depends on the end environment. And the liquid is not always a water base. A lot of customers, when they think about doing a liquid cooling solution, that's what they try to focus on. But in the case of a UAV or an air-based solution, you don't necessarily have water available. So we've done solutions around gasoline, jet fuel, hydraulic fluid, and whatever else happens to be available in the application. So I want to walk through a couple of generic case studies where customers have come in and asked for some specific solutions and the approach that we've taken to try and go through them. The first is a customer has come in, they have a mobile harsh environment. They're worried about the shock and vibration on the physical printed circuit board and then the reliability of the components on the board. So we've sat down, we've done an analysis to look at what is the shock and vibration as it's transmitted from the vehicle through the chassis, the wedge lock, and all the way to the individual board itself. And by doing that, what we've been able to determine is they need a form of a stiffener. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to be a thermal solution. It just needs to be able to stiffen up the board, not interfere with the components on the board, and not change how they're actually engaging the board into the rest of their chassis. The next case study was a customer that came in looking for a wedge lock. They had a very special requirement due to its small size, but yet they needed an extremely high contact force. Again, we sit down, we look at, you know, how much room do we have available? What can we do in terms of standard products? How can we take something and easily customize it without reinventing the wheel? That allows the customer to take their design from start to finish without a long production cycle. And if we're using standard components, it makes the qualification of the part that much easier because they can say, well, I've used this before, I know how it works, and now I can just modify it slightly to use on this new design and move forward. So then we have a customer that's come in and looking for a conduction-cooled chassis. They will be able to provide some amount of airflow to the chassis itself. It will be bolted down inside the vehicle. It is a warm environment, but it is not too harsh, so we don't have to look at doing a liquid cool. We can get away with the airflow. And what we've done is figure out how many cards can we actually get into the individual chassis by looking at optimizing the heat frame, the wedge locks, and the chassis size based on the customer's envelope to try and figure out what's the biggest one that we can do and still meet all of the requirements through all of the thermal resistance levels that we have. So as we work through these various programs, one of the things that we have recently been awarded is a program affordability award from Raytheon. Now, it's not because we develop cheap solutions. It is because we worked with the customer. We understood the customer's requirements. We understood what their time frame is, and we understand what their overall cost goals are. And through working through all the different stages, we were able to help them develop a product that meets their overall cost goals, but at the same time meets their overall program goals that they need so that they can go to production in the time that they need without being over budget, something not commonly associated with very many military applications. And back to you, John.
Thank you very much, Mark. Just a reminder to the audience, keep those questions coming in, and we'll get to them after our next speaker. Speaking of which, I now turn it over to Greg Shippen of AMD. Greg, take it away.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here. You've heard from both Margaret and Mark with regard to the various tools, challenges, and considerations that are needed to cool military-style equipment. I thought it was really interesting the heat frame that Mark was talking about, the challenge that it is in building and cooling equipment in this environment. And we here at AMD, I think it's maybe appropriate that we're the last on the agenda in the sense that in the sense that Margaret pointed out earlier that. You know, the underlying thermal challenges are greatly reduced when the underlying silicon dissipates less power and is more energy efficient. And to that end, I'd like to talk a little bit about what we're doing here at AMD to achieve those goals and make your job easier as you build systems of this kind. AMD has been driven by our primary markets to become more and more energy efficient. As all of you know, in the military space, it's crucially important that all of you leverage larger markets, the products of larger markets that drive larger in R&D investments and high volumes to allow you guys to build better products. And I think that here at AMD, we share that and deliver that into this market in a big way. And so, when we build CPUs, when we build APUs, which are combinations of processors and graphics, and discrete GPU devices, and even high-performance server products, We build, we are driven by our customers to reduce power, increase performance, and together produce more and more energy efficient products. And I'd like to make a case for that as we go forward. And I'll talk to you a little bit about some of the technologies we use to improve performance per watt. So one of the interesting things about AMD is that we have a corporate initiative that is directly aligned to the power efficiency that I've been talking about. This is what we call our 25 by 20 energy efficiency initiative, and it is basically the goal of improving the power efficiency of our products by 25 times over by the year 2020, so hence 25 by 20. And, you know, improving the power efficiency is pretty, you know, pretty aggressive goal for 25X. And I think what you see here on this drawing is that we have had to greatly increase recently the power efficiency of our products to get on the trend line that would allow us to reach this goal. So I'd like to kind of make a case for us being able to do that by using a a case study, if you will, and that it will be our Merlin Falcon, otherwise known as Carrizo. This is our sixth generation combined CPU-GPU device, our APU. It is in market today, and we've introduced in this device a number of technologies that will be leveraged across our product roadmap, including discrete GPUs, server class CPUs, and our upcoming APU devices. This is one example with putting some numbers behind some of the performance and energy efficiency initiatives that we have and parameters that we've improved on this product. So by innovating around the architecture, by improving the design, underlying design methodologies, we've been able to increase in this generation of product our 3D Mark 11 performance by 65%. We've been able to significantly increase the efficiency of our multimedia engines. And as a result, as you can see at the bottom here, what we've been able to do is reduce typical power by 2x while increasing the performance by almost 1.5x. And that results in a net performance per watt of about 2.4x for our Merlin Falcon Carrizo product. And you can see that this takes us really off, significantly off the trend line from our prior products, and is really the first of the designs that have been largely engineered under our 25 by 20 initiative. So let me go through a couple of things under the covers that we've done to improve it. One of the first things we did was to make a change to the methodology that we've used to create the actual chip design. One of the things that is, as I'm sure you're aware of, that goes directly to power efficiency and the power, the end power of a device, is the area used by the logic, because it reads directly into leakage power. What you can see in this slide, for example, is that we have been able to reduce by around the 30 to 40% the size of many of the structures within the within our CPU core and elsewhere in the design. This goes directly to reducing reducing power and increasing energy efficiency. Another example in this generation of design is to provide better granularity with regard to power rails on the design. As many of you are aware, modern processors have a number of power rails, some of which can be operated dynamically in terms of the voltage that it operates on, based on the frequency that it's called to run at. What we've done in our Merlin Falcon design is to isolate the graphics engine from the rest of the SoC and the CPU. And the next slide talks a little bit about some of the value proposition that you get when you can do this. By ensuring, for example, that you operate the graphics engine at the optimal power efficiency for the performance that you wish to run at. On the lower right-hand graph, you can see in red our prior products, and in blue, the Merlin Falcon design. And you can see that we've been able to increase the graphics frequency without increasing the graphics power in a power constrained environment by being able to efficiently control and independently control the graphics power. The other item on the right-hand side shows you another consideration, which is to be able to separate the SoC operating voltage from the graphics operating voltage. The SoC, for example, may have dedicated multimedia engines, DMA, or other kinds of functions which don't need a particular, which may not need at a given time a particular level of performance. For instance, if you have a graphics workload, you may wish to efficiently run the graphics engine at an appropriate power efficient level without having to drive the SoC and rest of chip at a higher voltage and hence a higher leakage power. The ability to control and move power back and forth to the most efficient point for the operating load of the application is one of the technologies that we've been working on to improve the overall power efficiency of the system for your kinds of applications. Another area that we've been able to do to optimize graphics is shown in this next slide. And this is a summary of some of the kinds of transistor technologies, transistor power, that we use to construct the graphics. As those of you who may be familiar with silicon technology know, there are various sizes of transistors that are available in the palette of a design library. Picking carefully which kinds of transistors you use to drive the design is an important consideration for power efficiency. And we have taken our graphics design and optimized it for low power by ensuring that we're operating with only the most powerful transistors that are needed to drive the appropriate frequency targets for the machine. Another consideration that we use is being able to power gate smaller pieces of the design rather than the entire large IP block. For example, in the graphics engine, what we've done is to be able to provide additional power domains to be able to control. So that we, for instance, if the application does not require significant amounts of graphics performance, there is opportunity to power down unused portions of that design without affecting the performance of the application. And we are able to do all of these things in a dynamic fashion. Another attribute of the Carrizo design is one of integration. In prior x86 designs, those of you familiar with x86 know that there typically have been, in the past, Southbridge companion devices necessary to create a system-level solution. What we've done in the Carrizo design for the first time, and we will proliferate this in our roadmap, is to create full standalone SoC designs by integrating that Southbridge I/O functionality directly on die. And this is a significant energy efficiency improvement because you no longer have to power the connection between the Southbridge and the rest of chip. And you also have an opportunity for powering them more efficiently and power gating them more efficiently. So in summary, what we've done by using all of these methodologies that I've talked about we've been able to very substantially improve the performance. And so I'm going to use a couple of sort of PC-centric examples here to show you, because many of you do have applications that are similar to this. You can see in an idle system, so when the system is not operating with aggressive applications, that we've been able to reduce that idle power substantially. The platform power by greater than 40%, and the actual silicon power of our AMD device by greater than 50%. So from 4.5 watts as a system down to 2.7 watts as a system. And if you are using dedicated engines on the design for things like multimedia decode, you can see that we very dramatically improve the efficiency by up to 60%. All of these use cases are similar to many of the kind that you would deploy in your systems, and shows the alignment that I've been talking about. Now, when we start talking about devices that are much more capable with respect to graphics, our discrete graphics add-in cards. Some of you may be aware that we made a very large announcement a few weeks ago of our Radeon RX 480 product, which is our latest 14-nanometer FinFET design. One of the things I wanted to highlight is that product offers 2.8 times improvement in performance per watt. And so this gives you an opportunity as a designer to choose. Do you want to have greater performance at a given stable power envelope, or do you want to take that power envelope down and keep the same performance from the prior generation? That's the power and flexibility that you get with power efficiency improvements. Now, all of our power technologies that I've talked about have an orchestrator on chip, a controller basically that provides dynamic power management. This is a small processor that has significant levels of technology in its firmware to be able to move power back and forth between CPUs, between GPUs, and other components that I've talked about on our designs. It has a very powerful capability to change clock rates and voltages applied to the design. And when all three of those elements, clocks, voltages, and power gating, are controlled by this device, you have very significant control over the overall thermal management of your solution. And our devices offer significant flexibility in this area. And so in summary, we have a very significant amount of capability with respect to all of our products that allows us to provide capabilities to increase performance, lower the thermal load that you have to deal with, and enable innovation in your products. And with that, I'll turn the time over, I think, to our to John and our Q&A.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for that presentation. That was a good one. And now let's get started with our Q&A. Go right to our questions here. Our first question is for Margaret. Margaret, what is the earliest stage of the design where designers can optimize the power thermal profile of their systems? Margaret? Okay, I'm going to hold off on Margaret's question for a moment, and I got one here from Mark. Inside a sealed box that isn't in thermal conduction with the part being cooled, how much benefit is a fan blowing into an arbitrary pin heat sink inside a sealed box versus using just the pin heat sink alone? Will the moving air inside the box increase the heat conduction into the box versus convection alone? Or would it make sense to use a small TEC versus a fan?
Okay, so adding a fan will increase the performance. Depending on the speed of the fan, you can see up to about a 10 to a 15x increase in performance. But there are going to be applications where a fan is not going to be allowed in the case of you know, a dusty or a dirty environment. So that has to be taken into account. If you do have a fan that's just sitting inside the box that is just circulating the airflow, maybe it's not drawing in any cool air from the outside, that also increases the performance, but now you're just going to continue to build the heat inside the box, and you may run into a situation where the ambient continues to climb beyond the reliability of the fan itself. As far as a TEC is concerned, or a thermoelectric module, those haven't seen a lot of use in the military electronics world simply because of their design. If a chip is dissipating 10 watts, and I have to put 5 watts into my thermoelectric to cool it, that means I really have to dissipate 15 watts of power. If I was struggling with the 10, then I'm really going to struggle when I get to 15, because that's a 50% increase in the power. So while that may work in an open environment, it's not necessarily a good solution right now in a military market until the thermal efficiencies of TECs come up.
Thank you, Mark. I have a question here from Margaret. Margaret, what is the earliest stage of the design where designers can optimize the power thermal profile of their systems?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's going to depend. It's going to depend on how much control you have of the different components in your system. Typically, you'll be using off-the-shelf types of products. You'll be using off-the-shelf antenna, off-the-shelf chips, and you'll need to design your thermal cooling solution around that and make design decisions there. That said, certainly if you're designing your own chip, your own ASIC, what have you, you'll be able to take a look at power consumption very early on in the architectural stage, and that's an area you can conserve, reduce wasted power as well as reduce heat dissipation. So certainly as far up in the chip and the architectural level, you could certainly make changes. That said, if you're getting a chip from a vendor, then certainly you're going to want to make early design decisions about maybe you're designing the board, where to place the components, what type of cooling solution, how many layers of the board are needed for real thermal and structural reliability. So certainly throughout all the different components of the system, you'll be able to make some design decision there for better thermal management.
Thank you, Margaret. And to the audience, keep those questions coming in. We've got about 10 more minutes or so for this to ask Greg, Margaret, and Mark questions. I got one here for Greg. Greg, what is being done for active power management in silicon to power down logic on the die when it is not being used?
So that's a very good question, and the question is actually alluding to one of the most powerful capabilities that we have, levers we have to improve power efficiency in silicon design. We here at AMD are increasingly aggressive at powering down pieces of the design that are not used. So, for example, I'll use the Merlin Falcon design I talked about. If, for example, your application never uses video playback, our codecs would be powered down that would be used for that application. If, for example, the GPU application that you run does not require the full performance of the GPU, we would power down some parts of that GPU. And in fact, there is a very careful interaction between the graphics driver and the power management controller that I indicated to control and orchestrate that powering down to ensure that performance is not impacted, but that energy efficiency is improved. And we will see continuously improving iterations of this in future designs. And I think you see this across the industry, where we all started with you know, entire chips. So in the past, we powered down CPUs. The entire chip that was a CPU. Now we're starting to power down individual blocks. and individual sub-blocks within those blocks. And we're just going to continue to drill down and drill down to be able to reduce the overhead of power running functions that are not being used.
Okay, thank you, Greg. I have a question for the group, but it was something I noticed in Margaret's presentation, how you really want to design thermal management at the design level. But with military systems, I found this when talking to folks who are designing power management, let's say for military vehicles. A lot of times it's an ad hoc thing where the vehicle was designed many decades ago and they're just adding on and adding on. Is it basically smarter as we get new programs when funding becomes available to really, are you seeing a trend where they're starting to talk about designing thermal management in from the actual design of the vehicle or the platform where things are going into? As opposed to just, you know, when you have to upgrade a system, then you talk about power management or you talk about thermal management. And I think it makes more of a challenge for the designer. Are you seeing a trend more toward, you know, with new programs of designing this kind of thing in from the beginning? Margaret, I mean, since I took it from your presentation.
That's a great point. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the most common mode that I've seen is that, you know, the end product or system owner is going to provide some sort of specs or requirements to whoever's creating those subcomponents of their system. Maybe it's the cockpit or the dashboard electronics. Maybe it's some sort of mobile device. They'll provide the specs to their supplier. That supplier, of course, is going to design the board, implement, integrate all the components, come up with a cooling solution, and essentially they're going to be delivering that subsystem to their customer and highlight, okay, this system's going to be reliable, it's going to be thermally compliant. Of course, there's other compliance issues like EMI, EMC, and that system owner will then take that subsystem into the final product. So definitely, as they are defining specs for that subsystem design, thermal management and thermal envelopes are going to be part of that.
Anyone else want to add to that? I mean, from your perspective, maybe at Wakefield, Mark, are you seeing some of that at the chassis level and such?
Well, I'm actually seeing a couple of different things. So customers are always looking for backward compatibility. So a system that was designed 10, 15, 25 years ago, they want to do the upgrade, but you have a limited space. So while they want the newest radar, they want the newest, you know, guidance system or whatever it happens to be, you only have a space of X by Y that you're allowed to make it fit, that you're allowed to make it fit in. So you have an extreme thermal problem trying to do the retrofit. If they're thinking ahead and writing new specs, they tend to be a little bit more lenient. You can always go back and ask for a little bit more space, and they tend to be a little bit more forgiving with that. If I go back and do a design and say, guys, look, in order to do the air cooling and not make our way into a liquid-cooled chassis, I need about an extra inch of space on either side, usually I can give it. But that doesn't work when I start to see some of the retrofits.
Thanks, Mark. And I know the retrofit's important at this particular market. I remember years ago a major manufacturer of a digital signal processing chip came out with a new family and didn't make it backward compatible, and it kind of lost some of its mill business. Do you want to add anything on backward compatibility of AMD devices, Greg, on that?
Sure. I mean, in general, we try and add capability as opposed to subtract it. I mean, that's generally what we like to do. The advantage that we have going forward is that the industry that we are driven by as a majority of our business is wanting lower and lower power, which I think makes it fundamentally easier to retrofit these kinds of applications. I mean, it's when the customer wants, you know, to fit 10 pounds in a 5-pound box, right? And I think that when you can provide significant power efficiency, it helps a lot in this battle.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, from your slides, and I know AMD is very well situated within the gaming industry. Is there some of the requirements in the gaming industry, do you see them kind of echoing some of the things that you're getting from your military customers that kind of makes it a little easier to marry that
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, gaming is like just about every other PC-like application, where the drive is to reduce the noise of the system, to reduce the need for fans, and all of these things are driving a significant effort to increase power efficiency, and this is going to make it fundamentally easier for our military customers to address. To use our products.
Thanks, Greg. I got a question from the audience that looks like it's for Margaret. What kind of analysis can we do at the component and system level to help ensure long-term reliability of military? I think we might have answered that already, but if there's anything you want to add to that question, Margaret, go ahead. I think we have some questions.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, something I didn't mention, didn't really highlight was really the need for that collaboration, really not just between the component and system level designers, but between the electrical, thermal, and mechanical engineers. What we've traditionally seen up to now is that these designers are operating in a silo. So electrical engineers are designing PCB boards, thermal engineers are developing cooling solutions, mechanical engineers are looking at at some of the shock vibration analysis. But what traditionally hasn't happened is a lot of the sharing of information. So a lot of the incorporating thermal analysis of the PCB board onto the electrical reliability, or mapping that thermal map onto some of your structural reliability analysis and looking at what's the impact of thermal stress. And that's certainly an additional enablement we can help engineers with, and make that an easy and efficient process to get at that analysis data, even if you're not an expert specifically in thermal analysis. If you're an electrical engineer, I'm an electrical engineer, I'd like to get access to that data without myself, being maybe an expert in that field. So that's certainly something we could do to help ensure long-term reliability, because this is going to help us see design issues and hotspots due to thermal impact.
Thank you, Margaret. And I'd like to, that brings us right up to our time limit for today. And we're sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the ECAST with more information. I want to thank Margaret Schmidt, Mark Palillo, and Greg Shippen for speaking today, and AMD ANSYS and Wakefield Vet for sponsoring today's event. And this ECAST will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending. I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media ECAST. Goodbye.